A major ruling this past weekend that could mean big changes for Florida's November election. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. A federal judge decided that Florida can no longer prevent felons from voting. What's that going to mean for November? We'll get the latest. Also, millions of Americans are out of work. Companies are being forced to adapt. What's the economic recovery going to look like?
What we thought yesterday was the answer. Time sometimes proves you wrong.
A conversation about workers and their options moving forward. And how are your children handling the pandemic? May is Mental Health Month, and we're going to look at our kids' mental well-being. And finally, do you miss the theater? Well, how about this? A show where the actor performs just for you while you're sitting on your couch. All of that today on Sundial. First, the news. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for joining us today. A high-profile court case with major implications for the November election came to an end on Sunday. U.S. Judge Robert Hinkle made a ruling that could impact hundreds of thousands of felons in Florida and their ability to vote. In November of 2018, voters overwhelmingly approved Amendment 4, restoring felons' voting rights. But the state was requiring that all fines, fees, and restitution be paid back before restoring that right. WLRN's Danny Rivero has been covering this case closely. He joins us now via Skype. Danny, always a pleasure.
Good to be on.
So the judge came close to declaring that the requirements for felons to pay back all fines and fees is a poll tax, but he stopped short of that. If not a poll tax, then what is he calling it?
So the judge, basically, this breakdown comes down to what people were being asked to pay. One part of that is fines and restitution, which are some kind of a punitive punishment for committing a crime. And the other part is court costs and fees. Now, in the state of Florida, if you get convicted of a felony, there's hundreds of dollars of these fees that get attached onto that. And the difference is that those are not punitive. That money actually goes towards funding government services, you know, funding the court system itself. So the judge said those are actually taxes. He said it's not a poll tax, but it is a tax. And you can't ask someone to pay any kind of tax in order to register to vote. So he said when it comes to court costs or fees, just squarely, nobody has to pay that in order to get the right to vote back. He did leave in place the fact that people need to pay fines or restitution if they are able to pay it. Now, that's the key thing, if they're able to pay it. He said if they're not able to pay it, then that should still not be a barrier for someone to be able to vote, and those people should immediately get the right to vote in upcoming elections.
All right, so how is the state supposed to determine whether an individual is able to pay?
So one of the major things that was a core part of this whole trial was there's been a lot of confusion ever since the state passed SB 7066, which implemented the need for people to pay all these things before they vote. It came out in the trial that in many cases it's just frankly impossible for someone to learn how much they pay, how much they need to pay before they can vote. And what the judge did is he said, look, the state has already made this determination in a lot of cases. If you had a felony charge and you were given a public defender, the state has already come to the conclusion that you are too poor to pay for an attorney. So that's one determination. The other way is after your case goes through, if you have fines or things of that sort, typically what courts do is they convert them to a civil lien, which is a civil process for people that can't afford to pay these things so that they basically end the criminal process. He says if either of those things have been done in your case, the state has already determined that you're unable to pay. So if you had either of those things happen in your last case, then you are basically already eligible to pay. The state has determined that you are not able to pay what you owe.
So what was the response from the civil rights organizations like the ACLU that were part of this case? What was their response to Judge Hinkle's ruling?
I would describe it as elation and an extension in many ways of the celebration that happened the night that Amendment 4 passed. You know, when Amendment 4 passed in 2018, in November, people didn't know what was going to happen. You know, it was there was a lot of hopes for voting rights advocates that people would pass it. And, you know, Floridians did do that at a 65% margin. And this ruling effectively extends that or underscores that initial victory. And the reaction to it has been unanimously praise. You know, they say, you know, thank God that this judge did this. This is going to extend voting rights for, you know, upwards of 800,000 Floridians is one of the estimates. And it could have a very big deal. It's a very big deal. So people are very happy.
What have we heard from the state? What do we expect from the state?
So Governor DeSantis just had a press conference where he all but just flat out said that the state is going to appeal it. All expectations are that the state of Florida is going to appeal this, and it'll go up to the 11th Circuit Appeals Court in Atlanta, and the state will see how that goes.
I'm talking with WLRN reporter Danny Rivero. On Sunday, U.S. District Judge Robert Hinkle ruled that the state's requirement for all felons to pay back fines and fees before regaining the right to vote was unconstitutional. You can read Danny's reporting on our social media at WLRN Sundial. All right, so Danny, what are the implications for November? You touched on this a second ago. I mean, does that mean that all of these felons can now vote?
That essentially, yes. And the timeline for this is actually very, very tight because the primary elections for Congress and whatnot, that is in August. And the deadline to register to vote in the primary elections is July 20th. Now, if someone is confused about whether they owe money or if they have been deemed as someone that is eligible to vote right now, part of what the judge did in the decision is he said you now have the ability to fill out a form and send it up to the state, and you send it up to Tallahassee asking if you are eligible to vote, and the state has 21 days to respond to that. If the state does not respond and tell you affirmatively that you do not have the right to vote, that they think that you can pay what you owe, then you can just register to vote. So the timeline is actually very, very tight. So it's basically between now and the end of June where, you know, potentially hundreds of thousands of people are going to start going through this process and then start registering to vote immediately. This goes into effect, two days ago.
You know, Desmond Mead is one of the central characters in this story, and you've spoken to many times in the course of your reporting. He's a former felon, and he's the executive director of the Florida's Rights Restoration Coalition. What was his response, and what does he think about what's coming up in November?
I last talked to Desmond just before the trial, actually, and I asked him, you know, what do you think about this as we're going into the trial? And I'll just read a quote of what he told me. He said, "When you knock down that wall, there's still going to be some stones there that make it a little harder to walk through." And he looked at this trial as just another stepping stone to helping Floridians get back their right to vote. And since the decision came out and people who are unable to pay the money they owe have now been granted the right to vote, he's come out saying that it's a major victory. It's another remarkable chapter, is how he said it, in this really historic fight to get voting rights back to hundreds of thousands and really actually over a million Floridians.
You've been following the story now for a couple of years. I mean, never since Amendment 4 passed. But, you know, after the ruling on Sunday, I mean, what was your reaction? Were you surprised?
I was surprised in how clear-eyed of an opinion it was. One of the things that the state law SB 7066 did was it threw a whole lot of confusion into this process of how someone would figure out if the law applied to them, if they could register to vote. And the state, by its own admission, didn't know what it was doing or how to administer the system that law put in place. During the trial, Florida's Division of Elections Director Maria Matthews said on the stand that, quote, "I don't know when the state will start to process these people that are trying to figure out if they can vote or not." And what the judge did is he came in very clear-eyed and he said, "If you guys can't put together a process that any lay person can understand and they can figure out if they have the right to vote or not, I'll do it." And he laid it out very, very clearly and basically he put the state of Florida in a very, very bad light because they were making it virtually impossible. The judge used that word impossible in some cases for people to learn if they had the right to vote or not.
And briefly, because a lot of states are watching what's happening with this case, this could affect people all over the country. But could this go all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court?
It could. And that is, you know, it's a potential. Before it does that, it has to go up to the 11th Circuit Court of Appeals. And if it's upheld there, it's worth pointing out just in the shorter term, if this is upheld at the appeals court, this would also apply to the states of Alabama and Georgia, both of which make people pay the fines connected to their case before they get the right to vote back. So even in the short term, talking about the next couple months, this could actually expand the right to vote in Alabama and Georgia, depending on how the court rules.
We've been talking with WLRN reporter Danny Rivero. You can find his reporting on Amendment 4 on our social media at WLRN Sundial. Danny, always a pleasure. Thanks.
Thanks for having me, Lewis.
So one of the other major stories that we've been following over the past couple of months, of course, is Florida's unemployment crisis. The Bureau of Labor Statistics came out with unemployment numbers for April last Friday. 13% of workers currently looking for a job. That's worse than the peak of the Great Recession. The coronavirus pandemic is forcing many companies to adapt and many workers to learn new skills for available jobs. How is South Florida's economy going to evolve because of the pandemic? Well, the Society for Human Resource Management is exploring these changing economic trends. Johnny C. Taylor is the president and CEO, and Dr. Alex Alonzo is the organization's chief knowledge officer, and they're both based in Florida. And they spoke recently with Sundial senior producer Chris Remington last week via Skype.
Mr. Taylor, I want to start with you. On top of your roles as president and CEO of the Society for Human Resource Management and working on the White House American Workforce Policy Advisory Board, you're on the board at UM. You're from Fort Lauderdale. As this crisis hit, what thoughts were going through your mind about how the economic crisis would impact South Florida?
Well, in particular, you know, I, as you said, being a South Floridian, I understand the impact of travel and tourism on the state, and in particular, South Florida. I sit on the board with of Miami as a trustee with the CEO of Royal Caribbean. So it's a really personal thing for me to, when I see the cruise industry be impacted the way it is, the hotels, the hospitality industry, it's pretty darn ugly. So that gave me major pause, and I began to wonder about, you know, what will be the long-lasting effects of that. That was number one. From the Workforce Policy Advisory Board, we fully began thinking about what can we do with people who have been working on cruise ships if the cruise ships are not sailing. So it became a very quick shift to the skills gap. How can we take these people and retrain them such that they can be productive citizens? We're going to have the safety net, social welfare systems, which include the $600 from the federal government once a week and unemployment insurance from the state of Florida. But that can't go on forever. It's not sustainable. And so it is very important for us now to figure out how to get these people back to work. And if they're not skilled to do the new jobs, whatever those new jobs are, we need to get them skilled.
So that's a really interesting point you make there. It's not necessarily about protecting these industries from the fallout of the crisis, but actually training these workers for the new jobs that are going to be available. How do you think South Florida's economy is going to look fundamentally different 6 months to a year from now?
Yeah, it'll ultimately depend upon how resilient the American public proves to be, and arguably the whole globe. So we know, for example, when I look back to 9/11, everyone thought that was the end. People will not stay in large hotels. They won't fly on airplanes. They won't do this. It's done. And if you watched airline stocks during that period and hotel stocks, they all. But it came back pretty quickly. Things changed. You go into the Miami airport, you can't just walk up to the plane, Eastern Airlines, like I did back in the day. You now have to go through something called TSA. So you put in place precautions, but ultimately, I see it a resurgence. I think people will come back. We'll just have a different way of experiencing tourism. So I'm hopeful, but I do know that it's going to require a different skill set, a different employee complement, And that's going to be the job of employers and government and educators, higher educational institutions, to ensure that we prepare workers for the future jobs, whatever they are.
And Johnny, if I could add something to that, what I'd say is, as I look at South Florida in particular, what strikes me is whether or not there is the infrastructure to support that type of reskilling environment. And so when I think about employers and large employers specifically in South Florida, they're very much leveraged in the tourism and entertainment industries, and so and in the hospitality industries, which are the ones most affected by the pandemic. And so one of the things that strikes me is how do those educational institutions, which are the finest in terms of creating those career professionals, rethink their reskilling programs to help individuals really meet the jobs of tomorrow? Because that's what we're defining here, is there are loss of jobs, but there are jobs of tomorrow that are popping up just as quickly.
Based on the data you guys have collected so far, what are the industries that have been more insulated from the economic shutdown or performed really well under these troubling circumstances?
So it's interesting because we've actually seen a host of industries actually grow or thrive in this particular environment. And obviously healthcare is the first one that stands out. But we've seen tech in particular, especially innovation and communications components, really being much more well-funded and growing in terms of their job prospects. And then we've actually seen some growth in the HR sector as well. We've seen some HR departments actually grow, largely because they're the people. They're the ones that are going to help us actually work through the employment issues that we see here. And so those are some areas where we see.
What have been some of the more compelling innovations you've heard about adapting to full remote work?
So a couple of things. I'll let you take the first one, but I let me just set it up by saying we've all talked about the benefits of working remotely, but there are some downsides too. And we have research to support it, and Dr. Alonzo can speak to it, but everyone's not cut out of this, and particularly they're not cut out of doing it immediately. We literally shut the country down in 2 or 3 days, right? And so you took people who were used to operating in a workplace, coming to work every day, seeing their colleagues, et cetera, and you put them into forced isolation. There's something very different about work from home as a flexible option and mandatory work from home, and literally working from home because the rest of the city around you has shut down. So you can't even work from home and go get a coffee and hang out with your friends or go to a bar afterwards. You had to go. We've seen millennials complain about having to do virtual happy hours because they were like, listen, I don't mind working from home if I can go get a drink after work. And now you're doing it alone. So isolation, depression, suicide, divorces, there have been truly some negative consequences flowing from forced isolation. And so just as we think about that, there's upside and there's downside. The other thing is we have research that would suggest that only 31% of employees report that they are more productive working from home. 69% of them say I'm either less productive or the same. So this, the headline being work from home is so great from a productivity standpoint, doesn't necessarily hold true in the majority of instances.
The only thing I'd add to that is that we're seeing that in particular, there's also a couple offshoot things that we didn't expect. And so I'll share with you, one group that's always kind of sort of bagged on from a generational perspective is the millennial. And the millennials in particular have been viewed as individuals who kind of want the entitlement of working from home, and that it creates sort of a problem, generationally speaking, in the workplace, especially as it relates to knowledge transfer. And what we found actually is that under COVID-19, millennials are itching to get back to the workplace almost as badly as baby boomers and Gen Xers, in large part because they now see the social value that exists in going to the workplace and the kind of benefits that you have from interacting with individuals on creative tasks in particular.
And I can tell you as a millennial, I'm in that group that misses the social interaction you get in the workplace. Mr. Taylor, you write a column for USA Today that answers people's questions about the workplace, and you've gotten a lot of interesting ones during this pandemic. One worker who's considered at risk told you her boss isn't letting her work from home. What protections do employees have in these circumstances?
So the short answer is very few. America, generally, there are a few states that have exceptions, follow this thing called an employment at will doctrine, which means you work as long as you want to work and the employer allows you to work as long as it wants you to work. And there are obligations for employers to provide reasonably, and that's important, reasonably safe work environments. But there's no guarantee under the law that your environment will be always safe. So we've always had people who've been at risk of picking up communicable diseases. We've always had workplace violence risk. The employer's obligation is to ensure that it takes reasonable precautions to make it as safe as it can. One thing that is very clear from the EEOC, from the courts, from everyone, is that generalized fear and concern about COVID does not serve as a basis or some for an employee to say he or she is not going to take a job or to demand that they be allowed to work remotely. 4 months ago, this was a seller's market. We had 3.5% unemployment, and we as employers needed employees, and then so employees could demand a little bit more. Now, you're facing 35 million people collecting unemployment benefits, 14.7% unemployment. The idea that you're going to make a demand of an employer when there are thousands of people looking for jobs is not particularly smart. If, in fact, one has a truly compromised immune system or one is in somehow a category, there may be protections under the ADA for a reasonable accommodation. But even that is subject to the employer's business, the determination about whether or not it's reasonable or not.
That's interesting. And another person brought up a question about vaccination requirements. Now, we don't expect a vaccine to be available for at least another year and a half to 2 years. But what does legal precedent suggest about vaccination requirements or about requiring to be tested for coronavirus?
Boy, now that is the big question of the day. I was just on with the EEOC chair the other day. You know, so the debate, it's an interesting argument because we've not really tested it. We've always, and I think people have to understand, in healthcare environments, in public schools, there's always been a standard, a requirement for vaccine, and in many instances, testing. In logistics and truck driving, we have mandatory periodic drug testing. I mean, so I think it's been specific to the industry. But given, and I'm predicting at best, what I'm telling you is that given what COVID-19 has done, it won't surprise me that the courts and the federal agencies are going to give a lot of latitude to employers going forward to test employees or require testing. And the answer would be pretty simple. We require testing. If you don't want to take it, you have a right not to, but you don't have a right to work here.
We actually have a precedent for this going back to 1905. There was a Supreme Court case back then that dealt specifically with influenza in 1905. And at that point in time, the court was really weighing the notion of safety versus privacy and health privacy in particular. And one of the things that the court sided with was actually safety, right? And so I would anticipate that courts are going to bake in and legislators are actually going to bake in some sort of flexibility in the long run.
It's interesting you mentioned the latitude that employers have there in requiring testing. On the flip side, talking about employee rights, we have a lawsuit now filed by members of the local transit workers union against the Department of Public Transit here in Miami-Dade County about not providing adequate protective gear for workers. Do we expect to see more of these lawsuits from essential workers who are placed at risk? And what protections do folks have?
So that's really going to be the area, and it's being debated hotly, as you might imagine, right now in Washington, D.C., whether or not we're going to give liability protection to employers. And I'll tell you where I fully predict this is going to end up. We've always, and it goes back to the fundamental idea that you've always been at risk. Think about this. One could have contracted the flu a year ago, took it home to a sick family member, and that family member could have died. The argument that there was, therefore, a liability that should flow through to your employer because one of its employees showed up with the flu is so weak. I can't imagine. Now, of course, I could be wrong, but I can't imagine a set of circumstances because that would open the floodgate of litigation. And we talk about the practicality of a judicial system. That means every time someone gets sick from a colleague, that person could then make a claim, a case, and it would flood the. So I don't for a second believe that the courts are going to allow those sorts of cases. That being said, if there are specific instances and sets of facts where an employer knows that employees are at risk, ignores that risk, doesn't take reasonable precautions. I'm not talking about guaranteed, but reasonable precautions, then I think liability might flow.
Well, you just heard from Johnny C. Taylor, President and CEO of the Society for Human Resource Management, as well as Dr. Alex Alonzo, Chief Knowledge Officer, and they both were speaking with Sundial Senior Producer Chris Remington. And we want to hear from you. How do you think South Florida's economy is going to change and adapt because of this pandemic? Is tourism going to roar back? Find us on Facebook or Twitter at WLRN Sundial. Well, still to come, all of us are struggling in different ways, but how about our kids? A conversation with a child psychiatrist coming up next. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. The coronavirus pandemic is stressing all of us, physically and mentally. Parents may be struggling with teaching and entertaining their kids, and those children are also struggling. The Center for Disease Control reported that 2 million children in this country are diagnosed with depression. Another 4 million are diagnosed with anxiety disorder, and that was before the pandemic. So how can you talk with your kids about these topics, and how do you help them navigate during a time when we're all struggling? Dr. Howard Pratt is a child psychiatrist at Community Health of South Florida. Dr. Pratt, I really appreciate the time.
Thank you for having me.
So I just mentioned children have already been dealing with depression and anxiety, and that was before the pandemic. So what has the pandemic done to them now?
Well, one of the things with the self-quarantining for COVID, it's like a pressure cooker. If there was already anxiety there, it's going to make it worse. Some of the outlets that kids have, you know, going to school, the social aspects of things, getting away from mom and dad, those are gone. And everything has taken a different shape. Even their schooling now is at home, and mom and dad are now, you know, teachers. So it's made things significantly worse.
You know, we talk about how this is affecting adults, you know, the stresses of work, whether we're going to have a job or not, and dealing with financial issues and so forth. But for kids, how are their challenges different? Is it really just they're reacting to us, or is it something more?
Well, I think it's a little bit of both, where, you know, if parents are going through their own stresses, kids are very aware of it. Kids are not dumb. They know when mom and dad are worried about finances, how they're going to pay the rent, job security. They're going to feel that. Now, add to that, especially the kids that are going through transition, because they're going to go through transitions differently than anyone else has. Specifically, the people that are graduating from high school. I had a patient just recently talk to me about how frustrated he was because, you know, he thought he was going away to school. That's all changed. Now he didn't get prom. He didn't get the graduation. You know, he is still going to be doing the same type of schooling at home. So it's one of these things where we're really not sure how the future is going to look. And for kids, it's overwhelming. You can empathize with them, but you can't truly understand or understand what it feels like for them right now.
I want to break this up into two groups, if possible. I want to look at young children and then teens. So let's look at like 5 to 10 years old, and what are they dealing with? I mean, when you talk about kids that young, I guess maybe it's an assumption. I always thought, well, they're resilient. Children are resilient, but really, I mean, they're dealing with stress and anxiety.
Yes. You know, when you're talking about at that young of an age, the unfortunate thing is they don't quite understand what's going on. And they just know that they're no longer able to do things the same way that they did. You know, going outside is now with a mask, and this is all overwhelming. Kids are resilient, but they're resilient to a point. You know, we're just now, I feel like, in more recent years, being aware that kids are suffering with depression and anxiety. A few years ago, you just say, well, how is the kid doing in school? Okay, they have good grades. That's fine. Or we give them a diagnosis of ADHD. Now, I think it's good that we're aware of it, but we have to address it early and not ignore it, not just dismiss it, because it doesn't improve by not sitting down and addressing it.
And you talked about what kids know. From your experience, do parents talk to their kids much about, you know, what's happening? Do they talk about not only what they're going through as parents, but just, you know, are they talking with their kids about everything that's going on in the news and what you see online? Do they explain it?
Well, it's what I see in my patients is that I have extremes where everything is shared with kids, and sometimes that's too much. You know, you can't leave the news playing in the background 24/7 and just hand kids these huge problems that they really can't do anything about but worry. Then you have the opposite of that, where it's like, you know, families that don't communicate about what's going on, and you get even more anxiety about that. You know, there's uncertainty creates anxiety.
So those, you know, talking again about 5 to 10 year olds, and so I wanted to know, what's the difference between that and, say, you know, you start talking about teens and, you know, 12, 13, 14 and up to 18. For them, you did just touch on, you know, like high schoolers. I mean, they missed out on prom. They don't get a graduation.
Yes.
But, you know, for teens, what are some of the other big stresses that they're dealing with?
Well, for teens, you know, they're at a point where they can understand a little bit about what's going on. And there is, at least the intellectually, they can grasp it. But you have to understand that age group is, the social aspect of their lives is very important. And so, you know, a lot of kids may say they don't like school, but they like going to school with kids their own age. So that's been taken away. When they come to me, they talk about it, but there's this uncertainty, just like with the kids. But it comes from a more intellectual place. To me, they do much better with therapy in that aspect, because at that age group, I don't know if you remember, but when, say, 13 years old, kids start talking to their parents less and more to their friends. So,
yeah. I remember. I remember well. Absolutely.
Right. And, you know, you can tell your kids, yeah, you can tell me anything. I'm not going to be mad. They're not buying it. This is where I definitely think that therapy can step in and play a big part.
I'm talking with Dr. Howard Pratt, a child psychiatrist at Community Health of South Florida. Many children are struggling through this pandemic as well, dealing with stress and anxiety, missing that social interaction. They're also struggling, like the rest of us. We all are on some level. And I want to mention, by the way, too, that May is Mental Health Month. So just to bring that up. So Dr. Pratt, when a child comes in for you, is it better to have the parent there or not? Maybe instead say, you know what, mom, dad, wait outside. I got to talk to this child alone.
Thank you for that. That's a really good question. Let me tell you, when I see, you know, a patient, whether they are, you know, a child, younger age or older, I always have the parent in the room at first, but then at some point, you know, I want to talk to them alone, because the thing is, when you talk to your parents, there are consequences, you know. It's something that, and also I do want to mention, we're doing telemedicine. So a lot of times they're not coming in just for safety aspects. Only reason I'm saying that is I don't want anyone getting sick trying to get in to see me. But I do both. And then I talk to them both at the end. It's very important.
And that's interesting that we are, because so much of what we do now is, you know, it's through our computer. We're now talking to each other through Zoom or Google Chat or whatever it is.
Yeah.
But you will see patients if they feel they need, they have to, you will see them. But how does that change when you're doing it through a screen? How does that change the way that you're treating them and how you're interacting with them?
Well, I'll be honest. I prefer to see my patients in person. I do think there's something lost. But having no interaction at all or people not getting the treatment they needed, that's not going to work. So it's fairly the same, I'll be honest with you. When I know a lot of other colleagues and I, when we first started doing this, it was kind of like, I just don't want to do this. I'd rather have them come in. But it's really the same. as far as the treatment goes. You know, I still talk to the parents. I still talk with the kids. Privacy is really important. There has to be an area where that patient, that child, feels like they can talk without, you know, everyone eavesdropping. But it's really facilitated during this whole COVID time.
You know, in talking with parents, you know, how do you start? Where do you start the process? You know, what should parents be looking for if they have to determine that, you know what, my child needs to see someone like you?
Well, I always say look for changes, okay? And I always say find out what's going on with their social media. That's going to be a huge indicator of a lot of things going on because a lot of kids live out their emotions online. And they don't necessarily bring their issues home and tell them, hey, I'm having problems with this person at school or I'm being bullied. So I look for changes in grades. I look for if there's drug use, if there's isolation. You know, and the thing is having someone talk to someone is not that significant of an issue. I'd rather have a situation where you bring a kid in and feel like, oh, things are okay, versus things are not okay and it's never addressed.
You know, we talk about the stresses parents are going through right now, and part of it is work, which means they're going to be hurting financially. And, you know, the cost of a traditional psychiatrist might be a little bit much, but, you know, what are you worried about in that situation where families might find themselves just stuck and saying, maybe I can't afford treatment right now? Are there free resources, free counseling?
Where I work is the community health center. One of the things I like about that is it's kind of the last line before a lot of people they don't have services. So when I see a patient, one of the last things I think about is, does this person have insurance? You know, so do not have a situation where you're afraid to take your child someplace because of the cost. Consider it, but we don't want to see anything drastic when it could be avoided. There's resources with schools. Reach out to your community health centers. At CHI, we see plenty of people that are in that situation.
The other thing I wanted to mention, too, is that, you know, students sometimes would depend on counseling they would be getting at schools. And schools right now obviously are closed, and that's becoming a lot trickier. But we're looking at, you know, extreme cases. You know, what kind of opportunities are there, you know, for help? And one of the things that you had told me about is that community health is expanding, and you're going to be building out more beds to be able to provide more opportunities.
Absolutely. So one of the things I wanted to say is that a lot of school districts are still providing services. Okay, again, it's not the same as when kids were in school, but let's be honest, those resources were stretched then already. But yes, we are breaking ground tomorrow. We are having building a children's crisis center that is going to be serving all the way from South Miami all the way to the Keys. This is really huge. It's a service that is needed. We are in such dire need of care for kids right now, especially the ones in crisis. If you don't mind, I want people to be able to take a look at it because we're actually going to be showing it online tomorrow. At chisouthflorida.org / groundbreaking.
All right. Something we could share on our social media, definitely. So, again, more beds coming, more help coming for children. But, again, just to remind people that, you know, not just because it's Mental Health Month, but also just the fact that, again, as we're all dealing with the stress of the pandemic, children are as well. Dr. Howard Pratt, child psychiatrist at Community Health of South Florida. Dr. Pratt, thanks so much for the information.
Thank you for having me.
Well, still to come, how are you going to see theater from around the world? Sitting on your couch. We'll tell you how, coming up next. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. It's going to be a while before any of us steps inside a theater or concert hall again. But to use an age-old trope in the acting world, the show must go on. A new production from Pop-Up Theatrics in New York and Juggernaut Theater Company in Miami takes the theater and brings it to you, brings it to your couch. Long Distance Affair is a series of six vignettes in six different cities around the globe with six different actors performing from their homes. Tamela Woodward is the co-creator of the project, and she joins us now. Tamela, great to have you. So the interesting part then is the pandemic comes, and now you've got to change things. When that happened, you know, how long did it take before you guys decided, all right, we got to protect everybody. The actors are already still in their own home, but now what do we do? How did you make that decision?
To make the decision to do the show came from a lot of our previous collaborators who, as soon as lockdown started in other countries, they wrote to us, Anna and I, and said that you really should bring Long Distance Affair back because it's a perfect show to be able to keep everybody socially distanced. and it's a great, we know it already works on a digital platform. And so because those folks were telling us they really wanted it to come back, we called up Juggernaut actually and said, can you help us do this? Because you guys are very good at this. You're very good. And it's such a crazy world. I think we can make this happen if we team up.
Let's talk about one of the programs within the show, which is the one that takes place in Miami. And let's meet Juliet. Who is she? She is fascinating.
Juliet hasn't seen her boyfriend in 73 days and is so lonely for someone to look at her the way that he looks at her, to be able to feel someone's eyes on her. And so she sends out to 300 people that she's going to do an eyelash extension class, and five people show up, and she's going to teach us how to put on the very best eyelashes just as an excuse to be able to look people in the eye again.
The performer is June Romero, and let's take a listen. This is really a lot of fun. Let's take a listen.
Hi, thank you so much for joining me. I sent the invitation to 300 people, but only you five showed up. Fantastic, because it means that you and only you, not the 295 people who ignored me, are special in the same way that I am special. And now we get to be special and make eyelash extension magic together. If you can dream it, you can be it. That's from the Buddha. Or Walt Disney. Or the Buddha. Anyway.
So, you know, Tamela, one of the things I loved about this in listening is there's an interaction. You're not passive as the audience. You're talking and you're actually there with the performer. They're bringing you into the story.
They are. This is participatory and immersive theater. It just happens to be online. But Pop-Up and Juggernaut, that's what we do. We do participatory immersive theater. We put the audience in the center. This is the same thing. We're not asking an audience to tune in, sit back and watch something happen. We're asking them to sit forward and be a part of the something that's happening. They are actually the story.
I'm talking with Tamela Woodard. She's the founder of Pop-Up Theatrics. And you can find more information about Long Distance Affair happening this week. Just go to our social media, WLRN Sundial. What have you been hearing from audiences, Tamela?
Oh, people have been so gracious. And, you know, we do something at the end of the day with all of the actors. We ask them what's the best thing and the worst thing. And every night the actors say, oh, this audience member, she really wanted the miracle. Ah, oh, these people cried. Oh my God, someone fell out of their chair laughing tonight. So the audience has really been present to it. People are singing happy birthday in Paris, and they are practicing their eyelash gluing in Miami, you know, and actually coming back and seeing more shows. So I think it's been a little balm in Gilead for some folks to be able to laugh at the absurdity of it, and to also share a little bit of what it means to sort of exist in the now as a human and wanting community. So people have loved it.
One of the things we have to get used to in this era is the fact that since we're all, you know, doing Zoom or Google Chat, we're all on a screen talking to each other, is the fact that technology is not always reliable. What happens when you know, it goes out. I mean, you know, what happens then? Does the performer come back, or and I wonder how that affects the performers.
Well, because the whole thing is live and the audience is really, really there and we're really acknowledging the audience, if someone disconnects and has to come back, then that's acknowledged. And it's like, oh, I lost you for a second, you know? So Cupido might say, did you get that address that I tried to get to you? Or, you know, our angel might say, this miracle's waiting for you. Don't worry, you're going to get it. So we acknowledge the fault of technology. We acknowledge not everybody knows how to use it. And we make sure the audience feels like they're always right and they've always done exactly what they were asked for. So it's a challenge, but we just roll through it with a yes and every single time.
Something really interesting when you think about theater, and it's the experience that you get going to the theater. And I was thinking about this. We had a conversation a week ago with a high school senior, and she's planning on studying musical theater at Berklee School of Music. She says she won't go if it's only remote. And she says, because theater has to happen in person. How do you feel about the future of theater if it's virtual?
I think that virtual will be a really powerful tool for theater making. And when we're all back together again, gathering, we won't leave it behind. It will just be one of those things that now comes forward. 30 years ago, there was no such thing as sound design in theater. And once the idea that we could actually like design sound for a live audience became something that was really useful in the storytelling, now we would never do a theater piece without sound design. So we're just going to find that virtual interaction will be a part of theater from now on. It won't be the only way we do theater because we will be back in person. But I'm teaching next semester, and guess what we're doing? We're doing it online, and it's an amazing reimagining of this program. So I would say to that young lady, if she's got some good folks running that program, they've figured out a way to help her discover how she's an artist, even if she cannot meet in person. Theater is about participation. It's about me laughing and you hearing me laugh, me clapping and you hearing me clap. It's about liveness. And we can be live together, even if we're not in the same place.
It's interesting. I mean, you're in New York City. I mean, you know, it's Broadway. Can you imagine, though, living there without theater productions in person, though?
Yeah, I'm imagining it right now. It's happening. You know, I miss Broadway and I miss my theater that I am an artistic director at, but I also really love calling up artists and saying, you're going to get a commission and I want you to figure out how to make a piece of theater for your local community. I want you to figure out how to still be a storyteller because I still want a story. Just because the theater's closed doesn't mean I don't want to be told a really fantastic tale.
Where do you think this goes from here?
I think few people are going to risk their lives to sit next to each other in the theater. So this form that we're all engaged in, this digital format, the audio format, the podcast format, I think it's going to get better and better. We're going to be really good at it in 18 months and 24 months. And then we're going to open our theater doors and everybody's going to rush in there. And this will be a part of that experience.
Well, I miss the theater. I look forward to going back, but I'm open to new experiences. So, you know, any experience to be able to enjoy performance, you know, I will never say no. Tamila Woodard, again, she's the founder of Pop-Up Theatrics. You can find more information about Long Distance Affair on our social media at WLRN Sundial. Tamila, thanks so much and break a leg.
It's such a pleasure. Thank you.
Anyway, that's Sundial for this Tuesday, May 26th. Sundial is produced by Chris Remington. Sherilyn Cabrera is our fill-in associate producer. Our engagement editor is Katie Lepre. Our news director is Terrence Shepard. Alicia Zuckerman is our editorial director. WLRN's program director is Jason Zapka. And our technical supervisor is Peter J. Merritts. Don't forget, you can always listen to the program again at 8 o'clock or just find our podcasts on your podcast app, WLRN Sundial. Coming up tomorrow on the show, Monroe County Superintendent Mark Porter joins us. Parents in the Florida Keys, we want to hear from you. If school reopens in the fall, do you plan on sending your kids back? What do you need to see? They have a task force right now trying to figure out how to reopen the schools. What do you want them to do to keep your kids safe? Plus, we're going to learn about the antibody testing that's out there. More and more sites are popping up around South Florida, but there are questions about whether you can trust them, how useful those results are. And restaurants are opening up across Florida at 50% capacity. Is that enough to keep them running? How are they going to have to adapt to this new world? The Miami Herald's Carlos Freya will join us to explain, and of course, we'd love to hear from you if you work in the restaurant business. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks again for listening. Thanks for your patience. You know, we'll get through it, as always. Stay safe. We'll talk to you again live tomorrow.